insane, determined never to release his Miranda. Mad with frustration, I waited. After half an hour or so, the lid suddenly gave it my push, and a few seconds later, I was in the sunlight again. Somewhere, I was sure, eyes were on me. But nothing moved, and Barani was empty and abandoned. My return to the banality of school life was nearly unbearable, but I was sure now that I had only to wait. At lunch on Monday, I had a letter from June and Julie's mother at the address in Dorset. She was glad, she said, that there was someone else English on the island, and she asked me to urge the girls to write more often. The letter felt solid and reassuring, something real in a world where all was pretense. By now, I bitterly regretted not having told Julie about Alison's death when she had given me the chance. But at least my silence there gave me one comfort. She could not have known the truth and still continued with the charade.
Nicholas, there is someone waiting at the gate for you. A beautiful young lady.
Nick, thank God you've come.
June, where's Julie?
In Athens with Morris. She'll do anything he asks. I just don't think it's fair to you anymore. I've run away from them.
You seriously expect me to believe that?
The whole business at the lookout post this afternoon was the last straw. She was in on it. You must know that.
June, I know what you're trying to do. Julie told me he wanted me to fall for you. You're still playing his game.
Nick, my name isn't June. Or even Holmes, for that matter.
Sorry, I've been bitten once too often. I'm not buying it. So come on, where is Julie?
Right now? Probably in bed with her real lover, Joe.
You're going to have to do better than that. You expect me to believe you'd just stand by watching while another man made love to his girlfriend?
It's not so hard if it's your bed she'll be sharing later, if it's the other man who's being made a fool of.
I had a letter from your mother today. I wonder what she'd think of what her daughters are up to.
She wouldn't think anything. She doesn't exist. That letter is fake. I can tell you what was in it, word for word. Something about being glad we have an English friend, and why don't we write more often. Do I have to go on?
Conscience shows you my mail.
I'm afraid so.
Then you know about Alison?
Of course we do. Your affair.
And what else? Did or didn't I meet her in Athens at half-term?
You know perfectly well you didn't.
You don't open all my mail, do you?
Only what looks like it might be of interest.
If you'd been more thorough, you'd know I did meet her. And told her about Julie. Alison killed herself 2 weeks ago. So now you know the true cost of all the fun you have at Barani.
Nick, please don't try to play Morris's game.
It's not a game. She killed herself.
But how could you let us go on? How could you behave as though everything was normal?
Because stupidly I was in love with your sister.
You should have told us.
And have conscience inform me that it's all part of the comedy of life.
Oh, God, what a bloody mess. That's it. Match abandoned. Forget everything I've just said. My name is June Holmes. My sister is Julie, and we do have a dotty, lovely mother, though she isn't in Cern Abbas. And Julie does like Joe, but she certainly doesn't go to bed with him. I know you'll say you can't believe anything now, but just come to the house in the village and you'll get all the proof you need. I'll get a message to Morris. The experiment will be stopped.
Who is he really?
Very nearly what he said. An eminent former professor of psychiatry at the Sorbonne, though he's retired now. Julie really was at Cambridge, but I read psychology at London University, then went to Paris to do my doctorate. That's how I met him. Joe is another of his postgraduate students.
And all that absurd Lily and Rose stuff?
Morris's little joke. There's a card in the tarot pack called the Magus, the magician or conjurer. Two of his traditional symbols are the lily and the rose.
And all the things he said about the war, the hostages, Eleftheria.
All true. Ask anyone in the village.
That vision of the pure essence of freedom was all very fine and inspiring, but 80 lives seems rather a high price to pay for it.
I agree with you. And I've told him so. But I respect his reasons, his whole set of beliefs. I think he's the greatest teacher in the world. Nick, you mustn't blame yourself over Alison. After all, it's not as if you lied to her.
We better go before we get struck by lightning.
It's such a relief to have everything out in the open at last.
Two minutes after I arrived at Conscious's pleasant little house in the village, Julie was in my arms, as June disappeared upstairs with a light kiss of blessing blown in our direction.
Nick, I'm sorry. The observation post, I hated doing it, but you know how persuasive Morris is. I haven't lied about one thing, though. I do like you.
I know that. Some things a woman can't fake. Shall we go upstairs?
Tell me about Alison first. We'd never have carried on if we'd known. She must have been so upset.
I think I was just the catalyst. A kind of symbol for all the things that had gone wrong in her life.
Did you go to bed with her in Athens? I don't mind. I just think we should be honest with each other. Now we're starting again.
No, I didn't. Julie, let's not talk about Alison anymore. Upstairs in her small bedroom, our mouths met. To have her surrender to me at last was a miracle. In a flash of lightning, I glimpsed the expression on her face as she unbuttoned my shirt. A kind of intent seriousness, like a child undressing a doll. She moved to the bed and I followed. Silence, then. A retreat from everything but the conversation of our bodies. Something well beyond the sexual. There was a future inherent in it. I knew I had won far more than her body. Afterwards, I felt a marvelous surge of euphoria. All storms were past, and we lay in the contentment of Eden regained.
Will you always remember something about tonight?
What?
That it's also how, not why. Goodbye, Nick.
What? Where are you going?
To the trial.
Julie?
I told you, Nick. My name isn't Julie.
A violent cascade of black-clad figures burst into the room. Joe was in the lead, followed by the actor who had played Anton. I struggled violently, but in a few seconds I was tied up and gagged. I twisted my head to see the door, glimpsing Julie's back as she walked calmly from the room. Then another figure appeared, conscious.
We shall not frighten you any more, young man. But now, you must sleep.
Anton held out a small case. Conscious took from it a hypodermic syringe and checked it was correctly filled. The needle pricked into my forearm and I felt the morphine flowing through my veins. My head began to swim. Faces and objects receded. And at last I tumbled down and down a deep black mineshaft of shock, incomprehension, and flailing depths of longed-for, impossible revenge. For hours or days, I blurred in and out of sleep. I knew they were trying to drive me mad, to brainwash me in some way. I shed tears of rage, a rage made more helpless by never knowing why they only wanted to punish me and punish me and punish me again, with no right and no reason. Then Anton appeared in a doctor's white overall, his manner clinical and serious.
How are you feeling?
Wonderful. I love being humiliated. I love having some whore trampling over every human decency. How long have I been out?
3 days. Today I have the trial.
What bloody trial? What have I ever done to you people?
You misunderstand. You are not the accused. You will judge us. Before, we have a small ritual.
Anton held out a rubber gag. Too tired to resist, I took its black tongue between my teeth while the straps were fastened behind.
Now, we go upstairs.
I was escorted to a huge underground room. At the far end there was a small dais, and on it a throne. Facing the throne was a table draped in black cloth. Behind the table were a row of empty black chairs. It looked more like a place of inquisition than a court of justice. I was marched to the throne, then made to sit down, my wrists secured by handcuffs. My gag was left in place. I was to watch, not speak. Then my heart jolted. A terrifying figure, a man with the head of a stag, filled the arched door, the antlers enormous. It was not the mask I was afraid of, but the reason for it, The stag paused in front of me, then went to the far left of the table. He was followed in procession by an English witch with black cloak and malevolent mask, a man in a crocodile head, an Aztec god, a winged vampire, an African folk demon, a squat succubus, a macabre pyro-skeleton, and some bird-fish hybrid with a massively swollen pregnant belly. Then Anubis the Jackal, alert and vicious, followed by an alchemist figure. Then a black sedan chair was carried in, like an upright coffin, its curtains closed. Finally, the last figure appeared in a long white smock, with two black bands around the loose sleeves. He carried a black staff and had the head of a pure black goat. Then, abruptly, the room was flooded with light, and the figures in front of me began removing their disguises, while 20 or so young men and women carrying pens and notebooks appeared and took seats behind me, like students attending a lecture. Of the figures who were now disrobing and taking their seats at the table, I recognized Conscious, June, Joe, Maria, Anton, and the actor who had played Vimmel. Lily was on the extreme right, dressed as the witch. Only one person was not revealed, whoever was in the sedan coffin. Conscious now rose and looked at me with mild academic interest.
Nicholas, you must long ago have come to the conclusion that you've fallen into the hands of sadistic madmen. And I assure you that is not the case. My colleagues assembled here are all experts in their various disciplines, which cover many fields, but especially experimental psychology. Introductions are not necessary, though. You already know our gifted costume designer, Margaret Maxwell, June Holmes or Rose Montgomery to you, and, of course, her eminent sister, Dr. Vanessa Maxwell, better known as Lily Montgomery or Julie Holmes, and, may I say, my most gifted student. We are an international group of psychologists to which I have the honor to lead. Our research requires us to have subjects who are not volunteers, nor even aware they are the subjects of an experiment. The first thing we must do is show our appreciation of the outstanding normality you have shown in all the peculiar mazes through which we have made you run. Nicholas, we are, of course, aware that you are filled with deep feelings of anger and hatred. We have therefore gathered here today to allow you to judge us in turn. But first, I call on Dr. Maxwell to read out that part of her report which deals with you not as a subject for experiment, but as an ordinary human being.
Thank you, Professor Conscious. For the sake of brevity, I will summarize. The subject of our 1953 experiment belongs to a familiar category of semi-intellectual introversion. Although excellent for our purposes, his personality pattern is without subsidiary interest. The subject has preyed sexually and emotionally on young women throughout his adult life. His method is to stress his loneliness and to play the little boy in search of his lost mother, thereby arousing repressed maternal instincts in his victims, which he then proceeds to exploit with the inherent ruthlessness of his type. In my view, our attitude should be one of pity towards a personality that has to cover its deficiencies under so many conscious and unconscious lies. I cannot end, however, without adding that during my relationship with the subject, I experienced a degree of emotional attachment to him. I believe this originated firstly in a physical attraction, artificially exaggerated by the role I had to play, but the second component was empathetic in nature. The subject's self-pity is projected so strongly that one becomes contaminated by it.
Would you describe for us your present feelings for the subject?
I consider he would make a very inadequate life partner in every respect except the sexual. He has fundamental partnership-destructive drives, infidelity, selfishness, an acute lack of empathy.
Thank you, Dr. Maxwell. All this may seem cruel to you, Nicholas, but we wish to hide nothing. You are, I remind you again, the judge, and the time has now come for your verdict. For this purpose, we have selected a scapegoat to represent us.
Lily stepped round the table and stood at the foot of the dais in front of me as two silent men in black entered carrying a heavy wooden frame. Anton handcuffed her to the steel rings on either side of it, then discreetly pulled down her shirt so her naked back was exposed. Then Conscience came towards me, and I realized he was carrying a whip, a stiff black handle ending in a long skein of knotted lashes. And I finally understood the incredible last trick they were playing.
You are now both judge and executioner, Nicholas. You are entitled to revenge. You have absolute freedom to inflict pain on Lily if you wish. You will be allowed up to 10 strokes, enough to ensure the most atrocious suffering. After that, you will be free of us forevermore. Think carefully before you make your choice.
He stood back. My wrists were freed and I tore the gag off. They expected me to speak, so I did not. I took the foul-looking whip from where it lay, and without warning I lashed it down on the table. I stood as if measuring my distance, ready to strike. I gazed at Lily's back. There was a very real devil in me then, an evil marquis that wanted to see the red wheels traverse her delicate skin. Not so much to hurt her, as to shock them, to bring them to a sense of the enormity of what they were doing. I looked at Conscience and saw in his face I had absolute freedom of choice. And then suddenly I understood. I was not in this underground dungeon with a whip in my hand, but in a sunlit square 10 years before, holding a German submachine gun. All his games had been to bring me to this. I was standing as he had stood before the gorilla, discovering there are strange times for the calling in of old debts, and even stranger prices to pay. As I lowered the whip, Conscience expected me to say the word. But I would not. I could not give him that satisfaction. I looked around at the faces. I sensed their relief at my refusal to act. My freedom. A moment later, everyone filed out in silence. Lily was the last to go, leaving only Conscience alone with me. She lingered for a moment, staring at me, offering no clue as to why she might have given me this last glimpse of her, or perhaps herself this last glimpse of me. As she went, Conscience turned to the table, then back to face me, once again a hypodermic needle in his hand.
Whether you wish it or not, you are now elect. Learn to smile, Nicholas. Learn to smile.
As the room grew dark, in that last second it came to me that for him the smile was something essentially cruel. Because freedom is cruel, and the freedom that makes us what we are is cruel, and that we have no choice of play or role. It is always Othello. To be, immutably, is to be Iago. I awoke staring at a ruined wall, an open doorway, and blinding sunlight beyond. At my side stood my suitcase, a thermos, a packet of sandwiches, a black box, and an envelope. For a moment I did not know whether hours had passed or whole civilizations. I opened the envelope, which contained a terse message typed on white paper. It said simply, "You are at the old city at Monemvasia. There is a ferry to Fraxos tonight." Finally, I turned to the black box. Inside lay a brand new revolver loaded with 6 bullets. The invitation was clear. Conscience's last joke. I emptied the chamber out to sea, then took the revolver by the butt and sent it whirling out to crash among the rocks. Near dawn, I arrived back in Fraxos to find 2 letters waiting for me. One was a reply from John Leverrier, saying he had no wish to talk about his experience with Conscience. The other was from Alison's mother in Australia, thanking me for my letter of condolence. There was a covering note from Margaret, still dazed with grief. She enclosed half a dozen snaps from Alison's camera from our final trip to Parnassus together. I stared at Alison's face, at the strand of hair that blew across the side of her forehead, that one moment still present and yet forever gone. Sadness swept back through me. I knew the Freudian jargon of the trial had been an act, a put-on, but I could not deny the essential truth of their description of my character. I saw it now, but saw it a death too late.
You cannot stay here, Nicholas. You must know that.
On what grounds am I to be sacked?
Neglect of your duties, unexplained absences.
Is everyone here in Conscience's pay?
I think you have gone a little mad, my friend.
I'm not your friend. And I'm going to the British Council, the Ministry of Education, the newspapers, anyone who will listen. I'm going to make such trouble.
The school has its reputation to consider. We do not wish any scandal.
Manly, for God's sake, you know what I've been through. Can we just forget all the school reputation rubbish and talk reality for a moment?
I do not ask you to forgive. I only ask you to not involve the school.
I'll keep quiet on one condition. That Conscience meets me in Athens.
No, that is not possible.
He better come. Tell him I'll wait as long as it takes. Melly, why me? Why was I elected?
Chance, my friend. Hazard. Nothing more. Goodbye, Nicholas. Good luck. And no scandal, yes?
I did not mind leaving the school, but leaving the island was like the loss of a limb. Whatever happened now, I knew I was exiled from Fraxos forever. As for the future, I knew I was cured of Lily, but I also knew her ghost would haunt any relationship I might form with another woman. Only Alison could have exorcised her. Her special genius, her uniqueness, was her normality, her reality, her crystal core of non-betrayal, her attachment to all that Lily was not. In Athens, I checked in at my hotel, then took the precaution of visiting the Ministry of the Interior to inquire about Anton's wartime report. It was all exactly as Conscience had said. A number of things were very soon established, too. Conscience had told the truth about the war, but lied about more or less everything else. He had never been a professor at the Sorbonne, he was not a doctor of psychiatry or anything else, and he had never published any papers, academic or otherwise. Whatever or whoever he was, he had left no traces of himself. When I returned to the hotel, I found a message waiting. It contained nothing more than an address in the Piraeus. I left immediately for what I felt sure was a final rendezvous with Conscience.
Excuse me, do you speak English?
You want lottery ticket?
I want to know who lives at this address. I'm looking for a man named Conscience.
He was here, but he's dead. 4, maybe 5 years.
Where are you from? The National Theatre?
Sorry, no understand.
I'll bet.
Mr. Conscience is buried in St. George's Cemetery. You go see his grave. A very beautiful grave. I show you.
And there it was, lying between two cypresses, a simple marble slab with, underneath a cross, the words in Greek lettering, Morris Conscience, 1896 to 1949. 4 years dead. At the foot of the slab was a small green pot in which sat a white arum lily and a red rose. The stems were recently cut, the water fresh and clear. There was a third flower in the vase I didn't recognize. It had a sweet honey fragrance. Since there was a rose and a lily, perhaps it had some significance. I put it in my pocket and immediately forgot about it. I stared down at the grave and I understood. It was his way of telling me that any detective work I might attempt would lead nowhere but a false grave and another joke. A Cheshire Cat smile fading into thin air. I walked back to my hotel with no plan or purpose, aware I was in exile forever, whether I returned home or not. The loneliness of it was intolerable. I was preparing for bed when the phone rang.
Hello?
Mr. Urfe, would you look out of your window, please?
There was a taxi parked in the side street overlooked by my window, a street lamp directly overhead. After a moment, the door opened and a woman got out. She went to the light and stared up, knowing exactly where I was. No expression on her face, simply the stare up. And a second later, she got back in the taxi. It jerked off very fast, its wheels squealing as it turned at the end of the street. It was all over in a few seconds. A crystal lay shattered, and all betrayed.
Hello? Who is that?
Margaret, it's me, Nicholas Earth.
Oh, for God's sake, do you know what time it is?
I have to know. Is Alison dead? Did she kill herself?
What do you mean tonight?
6 weeks ago. You sent me a note, the newspaper report. She took pills.
I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't seen Ali in a while, but last time I saw her, she said she was going back to Australia. Nick, are you all right?
Damn you. Damn you all to hell. Once again, I was the man in the dark, the eternal butt of the joke. All this time, Alison had been in Athens, perhaps even on Fraxos, watching me, judging me, while conscience moulded and manipulated her. One thing I understood instinctively, it was pointless to hunt for her. I only had to wait. They would bring me to her now, and this time I would use the whip. I booked the first available flight, and then, just before my departure, I remembered the unknown flower at the grave and looked it up. And there it was, on page 69, thin green leaves, small white flowers, called this in Italian, that in French, and in English, Sweet Alison. If Athens was depressing after Fraxos, London was 10 times worse. I had forgotten its ugliness, its termite density. It was like dank undergrowth after sunlit marble. Days passed, then weeks. The need to see Alison drowned everything else. But there were no phone calls, no letters, not the smallest sign. I found a scruffy attic flat, 2 rooms at the top end of Charlotte Street. Kemp, my new landlady, was a 1930s Soho bohemian. Untidy, battered, chain-smoking, a drinker. Her pottery and painting more heartfelt than accomplished. But her heart was in the right place, and I liked her.
You'll have to move fast if you want these rooms. There's a lot of interest. Dylan Thomas slept here, you know. Good friend of mine. My name's Joan, but you can call me Kemp. It's a shared bathroom, and you have to give the boiler a bit of a kick sometimes. Well, what do you think?
Has it been clean since Dylan Thomas left?
Just a bit of dust. You won't find better this side of Tottenham Court Road.
Fine, I'll take it.
Of course you will, laddie. You know a good thing when you see it.
Throughout that long August, I pursued the trail of Conscience and Lily. It kept me, however tenuously, in the mask, and dulled my agonizing longing to see Alison, a longing I knew the name for, but would not utter, even to myself. The sheer need for distraction drove me on. And then, one day in early September, my research bore spectacular results.
Can I help you?
I'm trying to trace a family called Montgomery. I believe they once lived here.
You mean Sir Charles Penn Montgomery, the surgeon? Well, my father bought this house from him.
He didn't by any chance have a daughter called Lily, Miss Lily Montgomery?
Yes, I know Lily. Is it her you want to see?
Yes, very much so.
I have her address somewhere. Why do you want to see her?
I'm writing a biography of a well-known Greek writer named Maurice Conscience. I believe she knew him during his time in England. If I could just have her address.
My gamble had paid off. At least something of Conscious's story had been based on the truth. A few minutes later, I left clutching an address card. Mrs. Lily de Cetus, Dinsford House, Much Haddam, Hearts.
Morris Conscious. I can't say I've ever heard of him. You say he's famous?
In Greece. I'm hoping to make him better known over here.
I'm not sure how I can help.
I think you might have known him before the Great War, perhaps under another name. There's a suggestion you were romantically attached, at least on his side.
My dear young man, do you know how old I was in 1914? 10. The age my youngest is now. Wait. You can't mean Mr. Rat. The funny little Italian man who came to teach the piano to my sister and me.
That could be him. But why Mr. Rat?
Because he had such brown, staring eyes. You know, like Rat in The Wind in the Willows. But I could swear he was called Gambolino or Gambadello, something like that. But surely not. He was such a funny little man.
Did he play the harpsichord as well as the piano?
The harpsichord is the plonkety-plonk one. No, I don't think so.
Just now you mentioned you have a sister. What is her name?
Rose. And you've got the wrong tense, I'm afraid. She died in 1916.
Of typhoid?
No, since you ask. Complications following jaundice. It was the great tragedy of my childhood.
I'm sorry. Did you or your sister play the recorder?
No. And we could barely play chopsticks on the piano. I'm afraid we weren't very musical. Is there much else, Mr. Orff? Only I have my Women's Institute ladies coming in an hour.
No, that's everything. And it's Orff, actually.
Oh, how silly of me. Well, good luck with your book. It's been rather jolly talking about the past. Mr. Rat, a famous writer. Who would have believed it?
Defeated, I rose to my feet and shook her hand, just as her young son appeared in the doorway.
Is it lunch yet? I'm starving!
In a moment, Benji. Mr. Orff is just leaving.
Has he come to see Lil and Rose?
Lily and Rose?
My sisters. They're identical. No one can tell them apart except me and Mummy. Only, Lily has a scar on her wrist.
Can you hang on for just a bit longer, Benji? I don't think your mother and I are quite finished after all. The harpsichord is the plonkety-plonk one?
Well, it is rather, isn't it? I've been expecting you for some time, Mr. Orff.
What if I hadn't found you?
Then we would have laid a scent. A couple of things you might like to know before we start. Morris is the girl's godfather, and my husband was the first English master at the Lord Byron. He was killed during the war.
I should warn you, I'm not inclined to believe anything you say.
My invention is at an end. I can only fall back on the truth now. May I call you Nicholas?
No, you may not. Are your daughters here?
No.
Alison?
Alison and I are good friends.
I demand you tell me where she is.
In my house, no one ever demands.
We'll see what the police think.
They would think you deluded and very foolish. I assure you, Alison has not been brainwashed or drugged or hypnotized or in any way unfairly influenced.
But you succeeded in turning her against me.
My poor, resentful young man. Alison has a very rare capacity for attachment. It is a precious quality. All I have done is to persuade her that she must not underestimate what she has to give.
How very kind of you.
Mr. Orff, you really are the luckiest and yet most blind of men. Lucky because you were born with some charm for women. Blind because you could never see that Alison possessed the one great quality our sex has to offer, a quality you have let slip through your fingers.
Helped to do so by your charming daughters.
Lily and Rose were nothing but a personification of your own selfishness. You fell in love with Lily in the same way a collector falls in love with a painting he wants and will do anything to get.
I'm wondering how much you really know about her.
I know everything, and I do not disapprove. If Morris were here, he would tell you that sexual fidelity is relatively unimportant. The one thing that must never come between two people who have offered each other love is a lie. a subject you perhaps know something about.
Are you daring to preach to me?
Are you daring to pretend you don't need the sermon?
What you did to me was evil.
Are you absolutely sure our actions have been nothing but wicked? Will you trust me, just a little? I am telling the truth when I promise you that now only one person is making you wait. If you are lucky, she might give you a second chance, but equally, she may not.
Mummy, I'm hungry!
Yes, darling, we're almost finished. Everything I've told you today is the truth. You can check names and dates at Somerset House. Please do it for your own satisfaction. Oh, Mr. Earth, I should so like to help you.
I'll see Alison in hell before I accept help from you.
But even as I drove back to London, I knew I was pretending to be angrier than I was. I didn't regret being rude. I deserved that tiny recompense at least. But this was now the mystery, that I was not allowed to meet Alison.
Dinsford House, hello.
It's me, Nicholas. I'd like to see you again.
We're on first-name terms now, are we? All right, give me your number.
You mean you don't already know it?
Goodness me, Nicholas. Was that a hint of a joke? You're becoming positively good-humoured.
I gave her the number. And then, within a couple of hours, something unexpected happened.
Nicky, there's some Yank here to see you.
Yank? What Yank?
Well, come down and you'll bloody well find out.
Hi there. John Briggs, London University. Sorry about the surprise visit. Mr. Conscious said you wouldn't mind.
Conscious?
He's offered me a job teaching English at the Lord Byron School.
Take a seat. Oddly enough, I was never clear about Mr. Conscious's position on the school committee.
Oh, no official position, apparently, just helping out.
Briggs was a tall man with a pleasant face, unmistakably American, as wholesome and green as a lettuce. Methodically, he went through a list of questions about the school, all of which I answered as helpfully and honestly as I could. Then, almost as an afterthought, he asked me about life on the island.
It's quiet, most of the time. There's no nightlife. And no women, I'm afraid.
Not a problem. I'm engaged. I thought maybe my Nancy could come out and stay next summer. Mr. Conscious was really nice about it. Said we could stay in his house in the village and that I could pay the rent by helping out on his dig.
Dig?
Remarkable find on his estate. What he believes to be the foundations of a Mycenaean palace. I've always loved archaeology. Could be extraordinary.
That I don't doubt.
I'll write and let you know how it goes. Any last tips?
I don't think so. Just my very best wishes. Of course, you'll find some of the experience a little strange.
I'm going with a wide-open mind. Prepare for anything.
Not quite anything, perhaps.
I thought, you poor bastard, and gave him a long, significant smile. I wanted him to remember that it was a smile that said more than the occasion warranted.
Thank you for meeting me here. I bought an 18th-century plate, and I think it's Beau. The V&A are so good at the provenance of things.
I met John Briggs. I told him everything about Barani and what to expect from Conscious.
We thought you would. That's why we sent him.
You know I didn't. But I might have.
Yes, you might.
Was he a test?
Shall we order tea? Look, there's the girl. Do grab her.
Two teas, please. Sandwiches, cakes, the lot. The lady will be paying.
That's beneath you, Nicholas.
Just my little joke. Tell me about Alison.
Everything depends on her, not us.
I'm not prepared to wait much longer.
Then she will be well rid of you. Wait as long as she chooses. I do not think it would be long. I hope she will forgive you, but you cannot be certain she will. You still have to regain her trust and love.
There's gaining back to be done on both sides.
That is for the two of you to settle. The God game is over.
The what?
The God game. A nickname, not to be taken too seriously. Of course, there is no God, and it's not a game.
Am I ever to be told the truth? All of it?
Morris once said, an answer is always a form of death.
I know I treated Alison badly. But all this colossal performance just to tell one morally bankrupt idiot what a fool he is?
Have you never wondered why evolution should have bothered to split itself up into so many shapes and sizes? Doesn't that seem an unnecessary performance too?
I know what you're saying, that there must be some purpose in our not all being perfect, not all the same.
And what is that purpose?
I suppose it allows duds like me the freedom to become a little less imperfect.
And did you have a sense of that before this summer?
Perhaps I needed the lesson, but the manner of it, the cruelty...
Nicholas, I know how much you must resent us. But remember, at that trial, you were the judge. And if you had not been changed by the experience, your response with that whip in your hand might have been very different.
How much does Alison know about the God game?
She understands what we are about, not the details. She agreed to the pretense of suicide only in the certainty that you would soon discover the truth. I really must go. What a waste of those lovely cakes.
I think one pays for the pleasure of not eating them.
Every now and then, I understand what Alison sees in you. Before I go, I must give you this.
But it's your plate. You can't give it to me. It's valuable.
I'm beginning to think it might not be genuine, but it's a fine piece, and it has an inscription, a Latin epigram I'm rather fond of.
Cras amet qui numquam amavit, quique amavit cras amet.
Tomorrow, let him love who has never loved. He who has loved, let him love tomorrow.
What does it mean?
I think that is for you to discover. Be patient, Nicholas.
It seemed cruel, this last wasteland of days, the dry stodge of time. As week followed week, I began to lose hope, to believe that Alison had changed her mind and abandoned me. And then one day, mad with frustration, I told Kemp the whole story.
Sounds like they taught you quite a lesson there, Sonny Jim.
I know. And I hate them for it, and I always will.
Then stick it to them. You're a good-looking boy in a po-faced, semi-intellectual kind of way. You can have any girl you want. Get out there and find one.
I've thought about that, but this thing with Alison, it has to be resolved. I feel like I've chosen her and have to keep on choosing her every day.
And what if she never comes?
Then I'll marry you. We'll have lots of fat bohemian babies.
I'm 50, you daft bugger. You know the only commandment that really matters? Thou shalt not inflict unnecessary pain. Sounds like you did a fair bit of that with this Alison.
I know. I was a child then.
Now you're an adult.
Trying to be. But it's like standing at the foot of an ice cliff every day, knowing you have to climb it somehow, but also knowing it's impossible.
For you, Nick, that almost passes for wisdom. Keep climbing, son. Keep climbing. What's that plate up there, by the way? It's new, isn't it?
Someone gave it to me. One of them.
Well, let's take a look. Might be worth a few, Bob.
Careful, it's delicate.
My God, sorry. It just slipped. One... Maybe we can glue it. Oh, you poor boy. At your age.
The maze has no centre. An ending is no more than a point in sequence, a snip of the shears. Benedict kisses Beatrice at last, but 5 years later... And Elsinore the following spring? So, 10 more days passed. But what happened in the following years shall be silence. Another mystery. On the last day of October, Kemp insisted I accompany her on a Saturday afternoon walk through Regent's Park.
Nick, laddie, I need a cup of the bloody national beverage.
So we went to the tea pavilion... And I waited as Kemp went to the ladies. And then, so quietly, so simply, Alison, at a table a few yards away. She was looking down, not at me. Now the moment had finally come. I could do nothing, say nothing, think nothing.
Without warning, she stood up and walked away. I gave chase and pulled her back.
Where are they? Are they here somewhere? Are they watching?
I'm alone.
I want to make one thing clear. I forgive you that foul bloody trick you played on me.
But?
But I want to know what the hell's been going on since Athens. And what's going on now? My God, you people. You even got the Kemp, didn't you? She set me up today.
Nico, don't interrogate me. Please don't. They're not here. At least I don't think so. It's nothing to do with them now. And don't let's talk about the past. Trade injuries, score points. I'm going back to Australia.
Then why come?
To see you. To see if I... if we...
Is there someone else?
No one special.
Does that include me?
It's included you since that day on Parnassus. I saw through you then. Forever.
There was also a moment on that mountain when I loved you. I know you know that. And I know you remember it.
Why should I remember it? Why shouldn't I do everything I can to forget it? Don't come any closer, please. Don't touch me.
Look, listen to me. Firstly, I'm nearly broke. I have no job and probably never will have one that means anything. I'm the worst prospect in London. And second, if Lily walked down the path now and beckoned me, I don't know. And the fact that I don't know is what I want you to remember. It's not much of a declaration of love, I know that, but it's honest. And it's the best I can do. And last, you've always been able to see this connection that joins us. And I haven't. But I think I'm beginning to. So that's it. All I'm worth. But it's yours, if you want it. But you have to decide now, me or them, for good. Choose now, while they're watching, in plain sight.
I'm going back to Australia. I mean it. Nico! I came back because I thought you'd changed.
I have. But there's only one way to prove it. And you have to take that risk, not just read their script.
Don't you see, Nico? There's no one watching us. Not now. We're free. Free to love or not love. No one's pulling the strings. No one's controlling our lives. It's up to us.
The final truth came to me then, as we stood there, trembling, searching, poised between all our past and all our future. There were no watching eyes. The theatre was empty. It was logical, the perfect climax to the God game. They had absconded, and we were alone. I was suddenly sure, and yet... still the worm and the apple. After so much, how could they be so inhuman, so incurious, to load the dice and yet leave the game? The eternal human condition. We know, but we cannot know.
I'm leaving.
You're impossible. I hate you, Nick. I hate you.
You can't hate someone who's really on his knees, Ellie. Who'll never be any more than half a human being without you. Who loves you. Who's finally trying to understand what that word means.
She stares at me. She is silent. She will never speak. Never forgive. Never reach a hand. Never leave this frozen present tense. All waits. Suspended. And I now will always know. Alison. Alison. Alison.
In episode 3 of The Magus, Nick was played by Tom Burke and Conscious by Charles Dance. Lily and Rose by Hayley Atwell and Alison by Anna Skellen. Lily Desitas was played by Beth Goddard, Kemp by Rachel Atkins, Melly by Chris Pavlow, and Briggs by Michael Shelford. Anton was played by Martin Dannenberg, Mrs. Marks by Elaine Claxton, Margaret by Josie Taylor, The Greek Ticket Seller by Andreas Karas, and Benji by Rudy Goodman. The Magus was written by John Fowles and adapted by Adrian Hodges. The producer was Heather Lama.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.